He wanted to open some sort of a nightclub, and yeah, he was really smart about the way he thought out his decisions. I think him becoming a father was one of the main things that made him want to, kind of open up his own business, build some generational wealth, and yeah, he like came to town to kind of see like, oh, what are some like nightclubs that are like doing well, and then he kind of looked for some that like weren't doing so well, and that's how he happened upon the place that would later become the Cotton Club, which is very iconic venue named after a New York nightclub. But the Portland Cotton Club is it's like this legendary thing that like I don't it wasn't around for too long, because it did have to close after a little bit after MLK's death. But it was this magical place that they dubbed as like the only place on the West Coast to find wall-to-wall soul, and it was on the Chitlin' Circuit. So lots of black, really major black artists like Sammy Davis Jr., I think Etta James and like Mama Thornton, like would come through there and sing, and a lot of local artists here would kind of get to like hang out in the wings and like hope for a chance to like maybe accompany them or like be part of the Chitlin' Circuit more. And so yeah, it opened a lot of doors for local artists, and it also was just a really big part of Portland culture and life. And that was only like the first business that he ended up opening, and it's just like, wow, so that was your first. yeah, but it's just cool because like he has such a he's such a like hustler, which obviously if you want to, if you're of his generation and you wanted to be successful as a black man or a black person, you really have to hustle. Like if you think you have to hustle today, it's like you have banks that don't want to loan you money. You have to rely on like loan sharks. You have redlining going on. And I think his ability to talk to people and like, yeah, I think that his interpersonal skills just really afforded him a lot, and he's just so darn easy to talk to. And something about his smile and his face and just like you feel like this familiarity with him when you miss when you see when you're with him, that's like, do I know you? Like, you know what I mean? It's like you feel like my grandpa, which is a familiar feeling that a lot of people in Portland have, and they're like, this is my honorary grandpa, which is, I think, why, or honorary uncle, or honorary mayor, which he's known as the honorary mayor of Albina. So it very much makes sense if you ever meet him, you're like, yeah, this guy, he is like the mayor. Like, he knows everybody, everybody knows him, But yeah, he's like the Portland icon, and he's 95 years old as of this year, so it's pretty cool.
It's really amazing.
Yeah.
I have to say too, I think your article conveys that sense of sort of familiarity really well, because like I got that feeling of like this guy is just like so sweet and incredible and compassionate and like really warm, and like you just get that through the article. So thanks for your writing
Oh,
also.
thank you.
Absolutely. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how Nall's life and successes have impacted Portland as a whole.
I mean, just on a very basic level, I think he's just a really big inspiration to a lot of people, just as like a human being, because he does have this like strong ethics. You know, he doesn't, he's an honest, he was always an honest businessman. And that and like his philanthropy and just being really involved in the community, I think have had, he's done so many things. I mean, it just, it's like what decade, what year? So like, I guess one easy way to dive in would be Geneva's Sheer Perfection, which was the hair salon, his final business that just closed in 2020 due to the pandemic. Kind of like the burdens of PPE and all that kind of stuff was going to be too much for the business, so they felt it was the right time to close, and he has a lot of peace with that closure. And it was just like this kind of cornerstone of the black community, where it's like you know, it like it had just been around since 1991, and you know, he was still there. He was still like in there answering the phone or sweeping something up. Like, I actually interviewed him like I want to say like 8 or 9 years ago for I think it was a Mercatus print magazine that I can't find, but it's probably in my house somewhere. But I remember I had to do an interview with him, and it had to be kind of a shorter interview because I didn't have very much space like I did with this Street Roots piece. So I remember having this feeling of like, oh, I wish I had more time with him. And I went to Geneva's Sheer Perfection because it was still open at the time. And he was just, you know, he was there. And then I would watch people come in, and everybody comes to say hi. And, you know, all the ladies want to come and give him a hug. And all the kids want to come and say hi. And it's just like everybody knows him, you know, and he loves to talk and loves to tell stories. And so, like, just that place being around for so long. When it closed, it was just kind of like this, oh, it's kind of like the end of an era. Some other things, some other ways that he's had an impact is things like the MLK statue, and that he was one of the main people to fundraise for the memorial statue by the Memorial Coliseum. And, you know, him and his wife Geneva being one of the first, if not the first, black couples to be seen like seated courtside at an NBA game. Just so many things.
Yeah, it seems like he's had like a really incredible presence just this whole time, and that alone has like really deeply influenced the culture here.
Totally. And I think if he were on the phone with us right now, he would make sure to bring up his wife Geneva, who was a trailblazer in her own right, just as the first like black female barber in Oregon, I believe. Yes. I think them together as a power couple was really part of the it really they were like personified like class and elegance and style and like commitment to their community and to each other. And they were business partners, so a lot. And he always says like if he hadn't been with her, or if it hadn't been for her, that he wouldn't even have accomplished most of the things he did, because you know they never saw each they were working all the time, and he as he said, she never made a fuss about it, and they had to just make it work. So yeah, it's like everything has to have like a give back element to it. It seems like it's like he's gonna have this huge 95-year-old blowout party, but all the funds are going towards a scholarship for kids. You know, it's like just really great things like that that I feel like him just being here like gives people something to rally around, kind of, because it's like I feel like he has a very grounding presence, and part of that is because he's been like a constant in this community for so long. So yeah, I think it's very grounding to be around him and to have him see his face on murals and around town and stuff is like, yeah.
Thanks for that answer. One of the things that he hopes to be remembered for is his love of his wife. So sweet.
It's so sweet.
So my another question that I had was, why now? Obviously, there's this big birthday party, but Paul Knowles has been doing incredible work in the city for quite some time. And I was wondering if there's any reason in particular that you chose to do this story right now.
Well, to be honest, it was offered to me and I wanted to talk to him again. And that was my main reason is like, I mean, doing interviews can be a lot of work. So I was like, I mean, this is like a no-brainer. Of course, I want to talk to Paul Knowles again. So that was my main reason. And just like, I just think it's important to celebrate your elders and like celebrate people while they're here. Because it's like whenever someone passes, it's like that's always the moment where everyone's like, okay, let's talk about everything they did and talk about how great they were and all the impact. But he's like a really good example of someone who we've continued to celebrate for a long time. Like he's been like the Grand Marshal of Good in the Hood and like is always like, you know, he's just, yeah. I don't know what I'm saying, but basically, I just wanted to talk to him again and learn from him. Honestly, like, I think me being a mom too right now, like now whenever I talk to like other generations of parents or grandparents, I'm just like interested more in like what was it like parenting during like the 70s. You know, like it, those are the things I want to talk. So like a lot of that stuff I don't think even made the cut for this because I feel like I was just like I asked him a bunch of things that didn't make it in, and like everything had to be condensed also, so there's a lot of missing stuff, but a lot of it was like I just want to like talk to him and like hear about things that I haven't heard him be asked. Which I mean, he's done a lot of interviews, so I'm sure people have, but to me it always seemed like whenever I would read about him or watch a news spot or anything, everything kind of was focused on like the businesses and the like the you know, all the community stuff and philanthropy and all that stuff is great. But I was like, wait, but like how is like did you and Geneva have like date night or like what, you know, you know, like those are my questions because I'm in the throes of that, so I'm like if I think it's rough now, like I would just love to hear like one question I asked him was just like, did you guys have like fears around bringing kids into the world back then? Because that's something you hear a lot nowadays. It's like, what a world to bring a child up into. But I'm like, I mean, as black people, we've always had a scary world to bring children into. So I was just kind of curious, like, if that even like entered his mind. And he was just like, he didn't really touch on fears or things like that, but he did talk about like he knew that he only wanted to have one child, or he's well because he had Paul Knowles Jr.'s from his first marriage, and he said that once him and Geneva had gotten together, that he didn't, you know, he was like, you know, we're not gonna have any more kids, you know, I don't think we're gonna, and she was like, well, I have three, and you have one, so that's four between the both of us. Sounds good to me, and just kind of like stuff like that. But I just loved hearing about just like the little like domestic life stuff that like doesn't get as much airtime and isn't like the fancy shiny like oh you're an icon type stuff. Just like who were you as like a husband? Like how was like just because I'm sitting in their house, which is like I'm like sitting in Geneva's seat essentially, or I think because it's like, you know, I'm like this is it looks like everything's the same as it was when she was here, you know. So it was just like very surreal and kind of felt like being like going through time a little bit. So, yeah, that's kind of what interested me is that I just wanted more time with him and to hear about other stuff.
Thank you. I would love to know. Okay, I have so many questions, but I am really curious about some of the other questions that you asked that didn't make the cut. If there's anything that stands out to you that you wanted just to talk about.
He told a story about he like got up for he was getting up out of he came home and his wife and her like girlfriend were sitting there like playing a dice game at the table, and he was saying he like they had some blueberry muffins that they made that were on the stove, and he went in the room to take a nap as he often did because he had all these different shifts he was working, and he like went to bed and then he woke up and there and the blueberry muffins were gone, and then she was like, oh, you didn't get one? Oh, we thought you had one. We didn't know. And then he was like, no, I didn't get any blueberry mumps. You know, he was kind of like a little disgruntled about it. And then he went back in the room and went to sleep. And then she came in and she was like, Paul, I baked you some more muffins. There's some right here. They're warm. And he was like, oh, I don't, he's like, I don't want them now. I'm sleeping, you know? And, you know, she kept being like, what? I just made them for you. Like, what? They're warm. You should have one. And he was like, no, I don't want them. He's like, I'm sleeping. I don't want one. And then he said that she came, this is, I'm not gonna do the story justice the way he told it, but he said that then she started chucking the muffins at him. She was like, oh, you know, MF-er, you know, you go eat these muffins. She just started like hurling the muffins at him. And he's like, it's the first time I heard her curse, and I never mentioned a blueberry muffin ever again after that. And then I asked
You
him
know,
about the
there's a lot of
marriage
love there
advice.
when you're chucking muffins at each other.
I know. And after that, I was like, on that note, any marriage advice? He's like, happy wife, happy life, basically. Listen to your wife.
Will you tell me a little bit more about his birthday celebration, his 95th birthday celebration? The title of the article is from his birthday celebration, right?
Yeah. It's from the after party.
Oh.
Well, maybe it's also from the birthday celebration. Unfortunately, I didn't go. Not because I didn't want to, but because I didn't know about it. I think it was like 400 tickets that they sold for that. So it was a pretty big party. And then there was at the spare room an after party. And he said that he was like, oh yeah, I kind of like heard about the after party, but like, he was just like at the regular event. And then someone called him and they were like, hey, you gotta come to the after party. This is, come on, you gotta come on over here. This is where everybody at. We're partying over here. And he was like, oh, okay. And then he went over there, and when he walked in, they were, everyone, or the, I forget who he said it was on the mic, but they started singing, and everyone was like jumping, bouncing around, clapping. They were like, the mayor's in the house. He's 95. He ain't taking no jive. The mayor's in the house. And he said that went on for 10 minutes. So I was like, that sounds like a party. And I believe he had a sign fitted to the front of his walker that also said, he's 95, ain't taking no jive.
Amazing. That sounds like a really good time.
Yes, it looked like it from the videos I saw.
Yeah, wow. So one other thing that really stood out to me from the interview and the article was like how carefully Knowles had planned the move down to Portland from Spokane, and like how much time and effort he'd spent in like sort of scoping out the scene, and like you mentioned earlier, like seeing what bars were successful, what nightclubs were like not very successful, and then he like kept showing up to this one and like working there a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, and that just really struck me. And then of course there's like a little bit of like I guess networking in there as well, that like his reputation preceded him, sort of. Yeah, I don't know. Will you just tell me a little bit more about his move down to Portland and like what you gathered from that?
Yeah, like you said, it was a lot of networking. He'd really made a reputation for himself in Spokane. And I think the person he res yeah, the Mr. Guthrie, I believe, in Spokane wanted to help him out, but he wanted to help him out in Spokane where he had built a reputation already. So when Nas went to Portland, he introduced him to Wei Li, the built with the builder business. But basically they had like a trio business, and then he ended up buying the final person out of it for like $2,000 or something, and then it was like all his and Geneva's, and yeah, paid off the loan, had a mortgage burning party. Yeah, I do think it was really interesting how him having all these different skills as like, he would work, once he got here, he was like working at the wine bar. He was a typewriter mechanic. He was a shoe shiner. He could barber. And then on weekends he was doing ski instructing, and he was, I believe, one of the first black ski instructors in the area too. So it's just like him teaching skiing to Mr. Guthrie's children, and then like working nights, and like, other people witnessing just like how hard he was grinding and how much he was doing gave him more leverage because he was so visibly like hungry for success that it was like people are like, well, this guy's clearly good for it. Like he's doing a lot right now. I think he wants to work. I think he wants to make some money. So yeah, it was like it was all these like little connections where he was saying like if Mr. Guthrie hadn't said what he said to Mr. Lee, then like I wouldn't even be here. So it was like literally his reputation that got him like secured him the loan essentially.
I was just wondering if you would tell me like some of your big takeaways from this interview.
I think one of the big ones was just me kind of thinking about what does success mean and like what does wealth mean? Because this is a person who's had a lot of success and like several successful businesses. He's still being, championed all the time. And it's like, I just think it's very interesting that if he wanted to, he could have. Like he could be living in like a much bigger house or like like and he is like kind of a bougie person like but like he's not like he's very down to earth and like he's living in this little house that he's been living in for decades. It's not like he's out here like, oh, I'm renovating my whole house and I have all this new furniture and like the fancy car. You know what I mean? Like he could do all that stuff, but he wants to leave stuff to his children and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren, and he wants to, like, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it definitely just seems like he's kind of like living within his means and showing his kids like what wealth really is. And it's actually more so about like community and family and friends and having like rich experiences and like not necessarily just like upward mobility just to have more money and more nicer stuff. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. To me, I'm like, this man is 95. He looks healthier than people like 15 years younger than him. He's sharp in his mind. It seems like he gets around fine even with his walker. He's living life, he's going out, he's being social. And to me, that's more, appealing than living to get, a bigger, nicer house or like something like that. Yeah, I think that was my big takeaway, was just like thinking about what wealth means and like what is like a good life. Because if he was just chasing upward mobility for upward mobility's sake, then he wouldn't have made the impact he has in Portland.
Is there anything else you want to add?
I guess when I was looking at this zine before our call, I was just thinking about how he was saying that he went to a pop-up market and featuring so many like black entrepreneurs and stuff. And he was kind of saying that that's like his vision, like what he would like to see for the future is like more black businesses having capital and having like just like village vibes almost, just like beautiful black people having all these businesses on Williams and coming out and having to be like a fashion show. Like that's like what he would love to see. So I think him getting like a little glimpse of that at like My People's Market, which honestly is like such an amazing event that I can't even believe exists sometimes. I think he was just saying like he couldn't believe seeing that, and I'm like, so there is like there's like things happening. There's stuff happening. Like, it's not like the Albina district isn't what it used to be. And, like, obviously, like, things like Vanport are like low key gone. But, like, there is more. I feel like with people like him around, we can, like, kind of like model the future after him in a way.
You've been listening to Street Roots Radio. This has been an interview with Street Roots correspondent Jenny Moore on her recent article, He's 95 and He Ain't Taking No Jive. For X-Ray FM, I'm Hannah Francis.
In every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. an outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies and I put down the old DAR. DAR, that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen. My faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter? Don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bus my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation. I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for, but don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive. I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings. Learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser. And that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland, on 107.1, 91.1 FM. The following show is a pre-record. You can find the entire X-Ray's family's archive at xray.fm.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a